Bibles to Luke chapter 16. Luke 16. A couple of review points. First of all, we're looking at a parable. And unfortunately, the word parable never got translated in our Bibles because the word for parable in Greek is parable. And for you that have been following with us, you divide that word into two parts. Para is alongside, and then the BLE is balo, meaning to place or put, to put or place or cast. So the word means to cast alongside, and it's a method of teaching. Parable is a method of teaching that utilizes the familiar to go to the unfamiliar. So the method is known truth to the unknown. It's good pedagogy, good method of teaching to express what we already know to go to the unknown. Let that unfold a little bit. Going from the known to the unknown. And in every case when Jesus teaches a parable, he uses something that the people are familiar with. For example, when he wants to teach the love of the Father for repentant sinners, and that was the setting, the Pharisees thought that to be poor meant to be under God's curse, and to be rich meant to be under his blessing. And in order to teach that that is not the way the Father's heart is, he is not one that holds sinners at arm's length. He is one to welcome sinners as Jesus did. And in order to get that point across, he goes to something known. All of his hearers knew about sheep. And they knew that sheep got lost. They knew that when a sheep was lost, you left all the rest of the sheep and went after one. They knew that the search for a sheep was never casual. It was very intense. And they knew that when the sheep was found, there would be some sort of celebration, some part of sort of a party. They knew all of that. That was the known. From that, Jesus then moves to say, that's the way the Father is. All kinds of effort and love are expended for a wandering sheep, and there's always a, to put it in this way, there's always a party in heaven over a sinner that repents. And that is the method that Jesus used called parables. Just to note the importance of them, we'll put down the number or the fraction 1/3, because 1/3 of the teaching of Jesus is parables. This was the most common means whereby he taught those that listened to him. And we're ready now to look at a parable in chapter 16, 1 through 13. Obviously, we need to understand the story. Now, he was also saying to the disciples, there was a certain rich man. Parables are often, in fact, usually introduced by the words certain man or a certain person. And that's typical, not to use names, but just to be very arbitrary and say there was a certain person out there. So verse 1, there was a certain rich man who had a steward. And this steward was reported to him as squandering his possessions. By the way, the Greek word for squandering is the same word that is used with the prodigal son who took his inheritance and squandered it. This same word is used. Reported to him as squandering his possessions. And he called him and he said to him, what is this I hear about you? Give an account of your stewardship, for you can no longer be steward. And the steward said to himself, what shall I do, since my master is taking the stewardship away from me? I'm not strong enough to dig. I am ashamed to beg. I know what I shall do, so that when I am removed from the stewardship, they will receive me into their homes. And he summoned each one of his master's debtors and began saying to the first, how much do you owe my master? And he said, 100 measures of oil. Remember, wealth was not necessarily in the form of money. Wealth could be garments. Wealth could be oil. wealth could be grain or wealth could be coin, such as gold and silver. And so this particular man owes him a debt, and he owes 100 measures of oil. Now, that's not motor oil. That obviously is olive oil, which was a very good possession to have. 100 measures of olive oil, and he said to him, take your bill, sit down quickly, and write 50. Then he said to another, how much do you owe? And he said, 100 measures of wheat. And he said to him, take your bill and write 80. And his master praised the unrighteous steward because he had acted shrewdly. For the sons of this age are more shrewd in relationship to their own kind than the sons of light. And I say to you, make friends for yourselves by means of the mammon. And mammon means material possessions. Money, grain, clothing, anything material. So if, verse 9, I say to you, make friends for yourselves by means of material things of unrighteousness, that when it fails, you may have to receive you into eternal dwellings. He who is faithful in a very little thing, is faithful also in much. And he who is unrighteous in a very little thing is unrighteous also in much. If therefore you have not been faithful in the use of unrighteous material possessions, who will entrust you or entrust the true riches to you? And if you have not been faithful in the use of that which is another's, who will give you that which is your own? No servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will hold to one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. And while we're at that verse, let me say a word about a Hebrew idiom. And that is the Hebrew idiom of hate and love. Understood as we would do so in English, we would understand hatred to be hatred and love to be love. In other words, in the English, we would understand this in terms of emotion. There is no emotion in this. This is a Hebrew idiom for choice. If you choose one thing, it is expressed as you love it. If you reject another, it is expressed as you hate it. And that explains many, many passages. Jesus taught that if you do not hate your parents and leave them and love and cling to me, you can't be my disciples. And our mind immediately goes to hate as sin. He doesn't mean it that way. That is not the Hebrew idiom. He's simply saying you've got to make a choice. Where do your loyalties lie? Do they lie with me, or do they lie with parents? Now, could it be that you could be loyal to both? Of course it would. But where there is conflict, then you must choose one over another, and that's called hating and loving. The Lord said, Jacob have I loved, Esau have I hated. You have men in the Old Testament talking about, was it Rachel and Leah? Where one was hated and one was loved. And the idea is, I choose this one. I don't choose this one. So the idea is the matter of choice. And this does not say in verse 13 that they necessarily conflict one another. It does say you've got to make a choice. And the choice is this. Do you choose to serve God, or do you choose to serve material things? You cannot serve both. And consequently, that is an idiom that is important to understand. Now, there are several things in here that were very... By the way, remember, with every parable, the reader understood the whole story. Do we? Do we have any idea of any rich people that have stewards? Is it a common thing to ask a steward to give an account of what he's done? In other words, does anything in this story strike you as familiar? And the answer is probably not. So, and the reason they don't is the stories are all taken out of their culture. It would be like someone telling a story about an automobile today and taking it back to the first century and say, did I tell you this story about an automobile? And the listener would say, what? What is an automobile? Well, when we go back to the first century and begin to talk about sheep, shepherds, in this particular passage, a steward of a rich man, and we draw a blank. So we've got to fill in always the background. So let's keep in mind the context. The context is important as the setting for every parable. All parables. And if you want to take the word parable, and if you want to think in your mind story, that's fine, because that is the essence of it. All parables are rooted in a historical context. They're all rooted in a historical event or a remark of some sort. And if we try to understand the parable without finding out what context it comes from, you might as well be reading the newspaper, because you cannot get the meaning of a parable apart from its context. Now, what is the context? The context is this. Jesus is dealing with the attitudes of the Pharisees. Or to put it in a broad sense, he is dealing with attitudes toward various things. The attitudes that he deals with are the ones that are specifically related to the Pharisees. For example, go back to 12:1, kind of get a run at it. And here we begin to deal with attitudes. And the first attitude is in chapter 12, verse 1. Under these circumstances, after so many thousands of the multitude gathered together that they were stepping on one another, he began saying to his disciples, first of all, be careful of the leaven of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy. So his parables are beginning to take on the attitude of the Pharisee, which was hypocrisy. Look down at 12:15. And he said to them, beware and be on your guard against every form of greed. For not even when one has an abundance does his life consist of possessions. Mental attitude, greed. This is the focal point in this part of Luke. Third, look at 14:11. For everyone who exalts himself shall be humbled, and he who humbles himself shall be exalted. He is dealing and answering the Pharisaic idea of pride. Fourth, 15:2. Now, 15:1. All the tax collectors and sinners were coming near him to listen to him. And both the Pharisees and the scribes began to grumble, saying, this man receives sinners and eats with them. And therefore their concept of God was wrong. They argued that God rejected sinners and tax collectors. And in this chapter, he corrects their concept of God. Fifth, and this becomes very heavy. Their concept of money. And their thinking was very, very simple on this. If you have money, that means God likes you. If you have money, this is a special evidence of his favor toward you. That was their way of thinking. And Jesus deals with that. Look at 16:30, for example. Sorry, that's incorrect passage. Well, the passage we just read deals with it, so we don't need to spot that because we're going to be studying it. So Jesus is focusing on all of these various attitudes, and he's telling stories that make a point. He tells a story that makes a point about hypocrisy, another story that makes a point about greed, another one about pride, another one about your concept of God and corrects it, and another one about money. And we're ready now to look at one concerning money. And we begin then with an accusation brought against a rich man. 16, 1 and 2. Or brought against the steward of a rich man. 16, 1 and 2. And let's start out then with his identity. 16, 1. Now he was also saying to his disciples, there was a certain rich man. So we focus first of all on this individual who is called rich. And we can begin by making the generalization that we made last Sunday, is that the Bible never, ever condemns riches. As a matter of fact, in numerous places in the Old Testament, Solomon, for example, God made him rich. We are told that Abraham was rich. So riches are never condemned per se. Sure, we note that. They are never condemned. However, the Bible does condemn abuse. They're never condemned. Abuse is. We looked last week at the book of James. Money that is obtained ruthlessly, money that is obtained dishonestly, is severely condemned by Scripture. But the possession of it is not. So we don't come onto this parable saying there was a certain rich man and that is automatically bad. That is not the case. Now in this context, this man has a steward. The steward is going to be the focal point. Often rich people who had clothing, they had grain, they had oil, they had coin, they would often assign a manager. So let's just put this man down for what he was. He was a money manager. He took care of the rich man's portfolio. He saw that bills were collected. He saw that they were collected in a timely way. At least that was his responsibility. Often, when there was a large estate, there would be a manager. And this is the case right here with this steward. By the way, a steward wasn't a slave. A steward was a free man whose responsibility was money management. So when you come to verse 1, there was a certain rich man who had a steward, a money manager, an estate manager. He managed his oil, he managed his garments, all the forms of wealth. And this steward was reported to him as squandering his possessions. Apparently from this parable, the rich man didn't keep a very close check. Perhaps he trusted his money manager completely and saw no particular need to check on him, but word has gotten around that this steward of yours is not managing your money correctly. Now, I see nothing in the passage that says the manager was a crook, that he embezzled money. He was not arrested for deceit or theft. His problem was inefficiency. So, verse 2, the news arrives, and here it is. He, the rich man, called him, the steward or money manager, and said to him, "What is this I hear about you? Give an account of your stewardship, for you no longer are to be my steward or money manager." And so the manager said to himself, What shall I do, since my master is taking the stewardship away from me? I'm not strong enough to dig. I'm ashamed to beg. So what he's saying is this: I've lost my job. And apparently he was not a very strong or well man. And he said, I can't go out and dig ditches. That's out of the question. I can't do that. I can't beg either. I've had a very honored position, and I am not going to lower myself to beg for food and so forth. So what's my alternative? What am I going to do? I can't beg. I can't engage in manual labor for some reason. And I think we could fairly say, apparently his physical condition made it impossible to do physical work, and his self-respect makes begging an impossibility. Now, verse 4 introduces a third alternative. I know what I shall do, so that when I am removed from the stewardship, they will receive me into their homes. And he summoned each one of his master's debtors, began saying to the first, how much do you owe my master? And he said, 100 measures of oil. And he said to him, take your bill, sit down and write quickly, down quickly and write 50. How would you respond to a person who came along to you and said, your house payment is going to be cut in half? We're going to forgive half, or think of any payment, car payment, whatever. Would you be inclined to punch them in the mouth? No, you'd be inclined to be grateful. I'm glad that you have done this to me, and as a result of that, wouldn't you be willing to do them a favor? That's the man's thinking. I'm going to go out and, I guess, literally buy some friends. So, verse 7, he says to another, and the other one owes 1,000 bushels, and he says, take your bill and write 80. That's not as big a cut as the first guy, but it's still very good. He decreases the debt. Now, that was not right. I don't think we need to argue the point. That was not right. And so, verse 8, his master praised the unrighteous steward. So in the context, we do not criticize, or we do criticize, what he did. Can you think of something good, however, you can say for him? He did the wrong thing, but he sure was shrewd, wasn't he? I mean, he had a good point, and his point was, verse 8, the master praised the unrighteous steward, not because he had cut his debts in half, but because he had acted shrewdly. So the point involved is he did the wrong thing, but even though he did the wrong thing, his owner does not commend his wrongdoing. He does commend him, and that's your key word, for being shrewd in what he did. Now that carries with it, I think, an important lesson. I remember being in Washington State, and being showed a prison, and it was a maximum security prison. And the warden that was showing me around made a remark about the prisoners. He says, you are going to meet here some of the smartest, shrewdest people in the world. He says, they have done some horrible, horrible crimes. But you're going to find out that they are shrewd. And he said, if you don't think they're shrewd, you ought to visit with me a whole day or stay a whole week and find out some of the shrewd things that these men can do. When we send tapes to prison, we have to send them in a clear case, which was nothing I would never really think of. But you got to put them in a clear case, because if they're not in a clear case, if you can't see through it, then they don't know whether they're smuggling a razor blade or not. They can't see. And can pull off some very, it's called, we have an idiom for it in English, someone who gets along well on the streets. You say they're streetwise and they're shrewd enough to get all of your money before you know that you've let go of it. And that is wrong and that is not commendable. But what can you say positively? You're shrewd. You really, when someone cons another person out of money, that's wrong and that's cruel and that's terrible. But what is it? Shrewd. It is sharp, and it is using your mind in the wrong way. And in this context, he begins to talk to the disciples about the fact that, unfortunately, you're not very shrewd. Notice verse 8. His master praised the unrighteous steward because, not because he acted unrighteously, but because he had acted shrewdly. Then he gives us a little bit of an axiom, and the axiom is this: the sons of this age are more shrewd in relation to their own kind than the sons of light. I think we've had a good living illustration. It's been in the Wall Street Journal a number of times, and it's the scam that recently took place with the New Era company in Philadelphia, who's now, or in Pennsylvania, is now bankrupt, who conned Christian organizations, about 180 of them and others too, for $100 million. And if you knew the man that did it, I talked to a friend of Billy Graham, and he said, you know, he said about 20 years ago, this same guy approached us with a, give us the money and in 6 months we'll double it for you. And he said we investigated and found out the guy was a crook. Well, come to find out, the crook emerged after 20 years and did a number on not only Christian organizations, but on some non-Christian institutions, and came away with about $100 million and a $600,000 paid for in cash house. And you know how he conned the Christians? Prayer breakfast. Our nation desperately needs prayer. We need to renew values and things that are important. And we know that you're an institution that believes God and believes His Word and operates on faith and wants to be good steward of God's money. And they would pray. And they would pray, and while they were praying, his fingers were in their pocket, away with $100 million. This parable has a point. Christians often are not very shrewd. Now, I think there's perhaps a doctrinal reason why sometimes we're not shrewd. Why would Christians tend to trust people? Well, because we're Christians. And that happened in this case, and it was a very foolish thing. And there is nothing wrong with if your mother or your son wants to borrow $50, be sure and do a credit check on him. And be sure to require 3 pieces of ID. Many times Christians operate that way, don't they? Well, just trust me. He's a fine Christian man. That's unwise. That's unwise. It's unbusinesslike. And as part of this parable here is, in your dealings, you ought to be smart. You ought to be shrewd in what you do. Now, you will face some criticism of, don't you trust your fellow believer? Well, no. I guess that's the only way you can answer. Do you think a preacher wouldn't put it to you, would he? A church wouldn't do you in, would it? A Christian friend wouldn't do it, would they? Alice? Alice is talking about an almost $1,500 loss to a friend. Neighbor. Friend. And that's part of the lesson being taught here by Jesus. Now, it's not the main point of the parable. The parable point, and we'll deal with this more next time, the parable point is this: one should use time, position, and all three of these things are here. One should use time, position, and wealth for future use. Now, isn't that what the story is about? This man knows that in the future, I'm going to be without a job. And in understanding that in the future, I'm going to be without a job, I'm going to use the time I have left. I'm not fired yet. I still have a job, so I'm going to use that time. And I still have my position. I'm still steward. And while still steward, I still have access to some money. So in the days I have left, I am going to use them for future use. Now, this parable will get projected, and we'll see it also in 1 Timothy, into the fact that a Christian should use his time, his position, and his wealth that brings eternal value. And consequently, we will have the major teaching then. When you have it in terms of time, position, and wealth, think about the future and use what you have now in order to have an important future. In other words, this man squeezed out his last opportunities in order to think about what would happen in a week, 3 days, or 4 days. And therefore, that is the major point. Now remember, all parables make one point. And that's the one point made here. Now we'll find some minor points or some secondary points that are involved. And so let's just put down, this is the major. And for our next hour, we'll look at some of the secondary lessons that flow from the minor. And we'll start with number one next hour. Father, we're thankful for your word and your truth. May we study it carefully in order to understand it, and may we seek to understand it in order to obey it. For we ask this in Christ's name. Amen.